morning. My name is Mary Ann White, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Date of my last drink, because in Texas we do give our sobriety date. The date of, we say in Texas, if you don't give your sobriety date, it's probably because you don't have one. The date of my last drink is September the 2nd, 1977, and for that I am extremely grateful. My home group sends its very best to you. My home group is the Early Morning Fellowship of Men and Women. We meet on Mondays and Fridays at 6:30 in the morning. We are a big book study. In the very beginning, we were doing a paragraph at a time, and then we began to get new people in the room, and we decided we would slow it down. And in my home group, we now read the big book one sentence at a time. And it's amazing when you take the book that slowly how it changes. You're going to hear a lot about that book from me, because that book is my lifeline, that book is my resource, that book is my answer to all my living problems, not just my alcoholism. I would like to thank everybody that's had anything to do with this conference. I mean, I don't think we've done it, but let's give everybody a round of applause. The other round of applause I'd like to give is to Walt and Mary, the Tapers. Thank you so much. You know, it truly is amazing. I have some absolutely wonderful news for you. It is a grand and glorious day. This is a wonderful conference, and the wonderful news is this. Well, I have good news, bad news. The good news is that Alcoholics Anonymous works. The bad news is it takes a long, long time. It was explained to me that sobering up and staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is like being kicked to death by rabbits. I would like to thank my wonderful, my speaker friends. You know, I sat here last night and I listened to Wayne. And the reason I listened to Wayne was this. And this is the different part about me today. There is a quality that God has given me through you people, and it's called fidelity. I've heard Wayne many, many times. But I am a friend of Wayne's. And I sat here last night because I am a faithful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a friend, and I know what it is to be a friend. It is the same way with Bob. Bob and Wayne and I end up at a lot of the same conferences, and, you know, put a blonde wig on Wayne, he can tell my story. You don't have to put a blonde wig on Bob, but he could tell my story anyway. And you know, I would like to tell you that we both have, all three of us have a lot of the same amount of sobriety, about 20, 22 years. And when you have 22 years, you think, oh my God, we are really, really mature people. We know how to handle things. We have grown up emotionally. You know, we're not those immature little kids. If you would have seen us Friday night, probably some of you did, sitting over there, you and your chairman, Barbara, your wonderful chairman, Barbara, we almost got into a fist fight. Glenda, we're almost rolling around on the floor. Mark is involved in this, and you know what it's over? Seats. Wayne was going to go home. I was egging Wayne on. Mark is kind of new to this, and he was just kind of appalled by the whole situation. Bob is up here at the podium. He doesn't know what's going on, so I have to inform him. I'm running up here saying, now, Bob, when you talk, be sure you look over here at us. I mean, I need a lot more meetings is what I need. I don't know how many of you have ever had the privilege of going to an international conference. There's one coming up this summer. Save your pennies, go. The very first conference I ever went to was New Orleans, Louisiana. It was 1980, and Ann and I were roommates in this. And I mean, it was just wonderful, and it was exciting. And there was the mayor, and he was giving a press conference, and there was this real pesky reporter, and this pesky reporter had this microphone in the mayor's face, and he was asking him all kinds of inane questions, you know, like, how are we going to feed all these members of Alcoholics Anonymous? After we sober up, we turn into really good little eaters, and how are we going to feed all these members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how are we going to move all these people around? And then he asked the mayor this one last question. He stuck the microphone in the mayor's face, and he said, and mayor, let me ask you one thing. Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous works? And the mayor reared back, and he looked down at this reporter, and he said, son, this town is in big trouble if it doesn't. I'm going to share with you in a not-so-general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. In other parts of the country, that is misquoted. I sit there, and the hair on the back of my neck stands up because they talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. Well, that's not what the book says, because it is the same as it's always been. It is life, and it is going to eat my lunch. It's going to win. It doesn't make any difference. It's what I was like, and I was the kind of woman. You know, we've had some rip-roaring drinkers out there that have been talking. And Robin, with her story, you know, I'm the alcoholic housewife. I'm the little old lady who sat at home and drank by herself and did everything she thought she was supposed to do and just got meaner and drunker and nastier as the time went by. What I wanted to be, I was always referred to as she's been drinking. She's been drinking. What I wanted to be, you know, willingness. Well, it's talked about willingness is the key. Well, willingness without action is fantasy, and I had that early on. I was willing to do a whole lot of things, but I never could do anything. I wanted to be able to express myself. I wanted to be able to, when my husband and I got into an argument or a fight, I wanted to be able to let him know exactly how I felt. And what happened was this. I'd get drunk, and I'd start to talk, and I'd start to cry, and it was lose all my effectiveness. What I wanted to be like was a woman I heard the other day, and she worked at the airlines, you know, on the counter, and it was one of those days at the airlines where they were having backups for bad weather, and you know how that happens. It's a domino effect, and everybody was queued up at the counter wanting to get on this flight, wanting to get on that flight, and at one point there was a man who jumped the line, and he's up there, and he probably was an alcoholic. He's pounding on the counter. He says to her, "Do you know who I am?" And with that, she doesn't miss a beat. She reaches over, she grabs the microphone that goes out through the whole airport, and she says, "I have a little lost man here. He doesn't know who he is." Now, that's my kind of woman. Now, this man, and why I know he was an alcoholic, because he would not shut up, he finally got up at the counter, and he looked at her, and he said, "Screw you, lady." And she said, "You'll have to get in line for that also." Now, that's what I wanted to do, and I never could do it. I am part of what you're seeing a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, a second-generation member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My father sobered up in Alcoholics Anonymous. My father died a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I made that connection with him from the very beginning. If a little bit is good, a lot's better. Always, I can use up 4 months' supply in 3 days. I don't care what it is. It's gone. I promised my mother I would never drink. My mother was the untreated Al-Anon, and I knew nothing about the disease of alcoholism, but I was soon to learn. You're going to hear also in this book, you're also going to hear from me about the directions. You know, we in Alcoholics Anonymous are so prone to stand up here and talk to you in such vague, general ways. I'm going to tell you some specific, exact precise things I do as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. One of the things I do is in Texas, they say five things. Now, I sobered up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we say 12 things, the 12 steps. But in Texas, they say you do five basic things. You get down on your knees in the morning, and you ask God for a sober day. You ask God to keep you sober. Then you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you can. You read some Alcoholics Anonymous literature. You make a sober contact. And if you have done that, and you have not taken a drink, when you get down on your when the day is over at night, you get down on your knees, and you say thank you. Now, I believe there is a lot more to do, and so consequently what I do is I do those things, but I also, when I get out in the morning, I say the third step prayer. It's crucial that I say that every morning. And the other thing in the book, it talks about on awakening. It doesn't say on the way to work. It doesn't say on the way to school. It doesn't say when I'm having my third cup of coffee. It says on awakening. And so I try to do that. And then I read in the grapevine. I also say the seventh step prayer. And I say it exactly as it's outlined in the big book. And then I read in the grapevine where a gentleman felt that he had to name the character defect that he and God were working on at that time. And so I say it exactly as it's in the book. And then I say it with self-pity and self-loathing. And then I say it with jealousy and coveting. Jealousy is the first emotion that I remember feeling, and I was 4 years old when I felt the feeling of jealousy. The big book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about jealousy, that most terrible of all human emotions. So I say jealousy and coveting, and then I kind of lump it all together. I say greed and gluttony and sloth and pride. And this one I added at the insistence of my sponsor, vanity. I had my big book open, and we were looking at it earlier. And in my group, we do the stories. And in the stories, those golden years, there's a line in there, and it says the necessity to hold up a facade had been irksome. Now, when I get to read the sentence, my comment is no shit. I spend a lot of time working on how I look. That is just a terrible character defect. And my sponsor said, as a result of that, we're going to do a little program stuff to try to work on this vanity. And she said, I want you to incorporate that in your prayers. And I said, yeah, okay, all right. So I did. Now, I'm going to tell you, be very, very careful what you pray for. One morning, after I had been out walking one morning and saying my prayers, I came back and I took a shower, and it was one of those days. And the only way I can explain it was a good hair day. And everything went into place exactly the way it was supposed to, and my makeup went on beautifully, and it was just, you know, and I got this dress, and I got to wear this dress that I'd waited for, that it was going to go on sale, and I finally got this dress. And for you men, you know, it's a shotgun or a hunting dog or a fishing boat or anything that you wanted badly. Well, I got this dress, and it was gorgeous, and it was silk, and it had an A-line skirt. That's the only way I can explain it. Gorgeous silk dress. And I'd said my prayer about vanity, and I get myself all dressed up, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I thought, you know, not too shabby. Not too shabby. And I said to myself, God, Marianne, you have just prayed a prayer about vanity, and you're just now thinking these things. And what happened was, I dismissed that thought. That was this person who, Steve, was so graphic and so wonderful. This is a person who sits right here on my left-hand shoulder. And it's called my alcoholism. And he tells me all kinds of things, he or she, whatever you want to call it. They tell me I don't have to go to meetings. They tell me I don't have to read the book. They tell me I don't have to pray. All the things. This person is telling me all this stuff. And Ed and Ann and I sobered up with this woman by the name of Liz. And Liz, the only way I can explain it, was a prostitute. She was just a prostitute in Alcoholics Anonymous in Pittsburgh. And I loved to go to meetings where Liz was. I mean, I was fascinated with Liz. I remember I'd sit next to Liz and I'd look down at her hands and I'd think, oh my God, where she's had those hands. And I thought, I wonder if she'll teach me what she does with those hands. It just was fascinating. fascinated by Liz. And Liz was the one who always talked about her alcoholism being here on her left shoulder. And she said, I had to give my alcoholism a name. And I said, oh? I said, what is your alcoholism's name? And she said, it's that motherfucker Leroy. So Leroy was talking to me that morning, and he was telling me that I didn't have to worry about vanity. The prayers really didn't count, and I went on about my day. Now, you know I'm headed for trouble right now. So I'm going to my meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a grand and glorious meeting, and I just love it. There's no such thing as a bad meeting. There are some are better than others, but it was a noon meeting, and I went to the meeting, and I came out, and I went to the bathroom and visited with my friends, and then I went about my day. And I went about Corpus Christi, Texas, and I went in and out of two shopping malls, and I'm going to the post office, and I'm going to the cleaners, and I had lunch, and I'm just busy, busy, busy. You know what kind of woman I am. I'm just running around town. And what happened was this. I began to have a sense about me that I was getting a lot of attention, much more than I had ever gotten before. And the attention went along this line. There were men digging in the street, and they stop digging, and they're leaning on their shovels, and they're poking one another, and they're pointing at me. And I stand up a little straighter, and I think, you know what, I think I'll walk a little further tomorrow. This walking is really paying off. And then there are two young boys riding a bicycle, and they almost have a wreck. I mean, they almost run into each other, and they get off, and they're whispering in each other's ear and pointing at me. And I thought, you know, those young men have good taste. They will probably marry women who preserve themselves well. And I'm going to a mall, and there's a young man almost as good looking as Mark, and he's walking, and he's turning around, and he almost runs into a post that he's staring at me. And I thought, oh, I hope his wife takes good care of herself. And this is just going on, feeding this ego. And I go into a little shop, and I meet a friend of mine. And she said to me, what is wrong with your skirt? And I said, what do you mean, what's wrong with my skirt? And what had happened is some 4 hours earlier, when I had gone to the bathroom, I had tucked the bottom of my skirt into the top of my pantyhose, and I had been mooning half of Corpus Christi for 4 hours. Watch your face when I tell that story. And I was at this tiny little conference, and there was this woman, and she was just appalled that I told this story. I mean, appalled. And she came up to me later, and she goes, I am so glad you had on underpants. And I said, I didn't have on any underpants. What? 23 years ago, I would have died if that would have happened to me. And that is my Rule 62 story. I couldn't wait to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell the story. That's the difference. That's the work that you all have done with me. It is unbelievable. One of the things in one of our literature that I was reading this morning or yesterday, it talked about that it was 4 years before a woman ever got, and I love the fact that they use this line, permanent sobriety. And what happened, I believe, was this, that there are a lot of stories, there are a lot of movies, there are a lot of pictures, there are a lot of jokes made about drunken men. There are not a lot made about drunken women. You don't see many pictures of mothers sitting down, drunken mothers sitting down with little children gathered around their ankles. In January of 1997, my husband said, I am not going to have a lush for a wife. That's not a very pretty word, is it? Lush, drunk. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, oh, I would get high, I would get tipsy, I would have too much to drink. And they said, no, Marianne, you got drunk. You got drunk. I had my first drink when I was about 19 years old, and it turned out to be tequila. It looks like this is a tequila run tonight. And it was one of those things where young people got together, and it's important that we remember. Most alcoholics can remember their first drink. Non-alcoholics can't. we got together and we pooled our money, and it was exciting. And I took the salt, and I took the lemon, and I took the drink. And what happened to me was everything smoothed out. That I had been that restless, irritable child. I had been so difficult to handle. I had been the only child of old parents. My mother was the untreated Al-Anon, and she talked about that she had had many abortions before she had me, and so that led into that feeling of that Steve talked about so beautifully, of not being worthy, of something being horribly wrong with me. And that desire, it was a desire and a need and a necessity for me to keep secrets. It was a necessity for me not to let you know what was going on inside of me. I swear to God as my witness, I believe it's genetic. I believe I was born that way. And so once I got that drink in me, what happened to me was I let the tiger loose. The tiger came out of the cage. And I began a career, and I'm not going to spend much time talking about the drinking. I began a career that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. It started with that simple drink of tequila, and then it progressed to where my husband and I would have one drink before dinner. It was just so simple and just so innocent. One of the things that really, really affected me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard stories like Wayne and I heard stories like Bob, and you know, where that they lost everything and they end up in jail and they wreck cars and they lose families, and you know, like Kleenex, it's just like they're gone, lost them. But that didn't happen to me. You know, I did not lose a family. I did not lose a husband. I did not wreck a car. I did not lose a job. And the reason why I didn't have that is because women like me, and there are some men now coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, that when we head for the bottom, family members, loved ones, society, well-intentioned people, they'll slide in a pillow just before we hit the bottom. And what happened to me as my drinking progressed, I have the disease of alcoholism, and I ended up drinking. My career spanned from 19 until 19 years later. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was drinking around the clock. Now, I don't look like a woman who has been drinking around the clock, and that's also for you new people. It is hard to, that's why we tell you these war stories. That's why we tell you what we were like. That's why, how much we drank, so that you will see the transformation, and I love the words. You know, the words in Alcoholics Anonymous, we use and abuse them so much. We use words like miracle. We use words like transformation. We use words like reborn. Like they're nothing. Like they're nothing. How many times have you been in a meeting and you hear, or been at a meeting where somebody's standing up at the podium and they say, I drank and I drank and I drank and I drank. And then here's the phrase that you listen for. And then, what is that and then but a miracle? It takes all kinds of shapes and forms and faces, but it is a miracle. It is a power greater than ourself. And I'm going to talk about God. And if that offends you and you still sit in the chair while I finish my talk, good for you. You're getting better. You are getting better. You know, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, before we get in here, if we don't like it, we're out of here. We're out of the door. We don't stick around for this kind of thing. When a 15-minute speaker was talking about her daughter, that was the thing that just started it. I have two children, and I have a grown daughter, and I have a grown son. And I swore when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had not hurt them. And God is very kind and very merciful, because he doesn't allow us to see the damage that we've done until he readies us to see the reality of it. When my son was 13 years old and my daughter was 15, we were living in Bethesda, Maryland, and my husband and I were having one of those fights. You know how those fights go? And it had to do with my drinking. And I was losing the fight, and you know how we have to turn the tide of battle? Well, I had to do something to somehow or another turn this tide of battle, and I was losing it. And we lived in a contemporary home that had three or four flights up, probably seven steps. And I'm standing there thinking, okay, what I'm going to do is throw myself down this small flight of stairs and not hurt myself too badly. And that'll stop the argument. I mean, my husband will be very concerned and he'll come running down and help me. And so I figured out how I was going to do this. And I threw myself down those 7 steps. And at that point, my 13-year-old son came out of the bedroom, and my 15-year-old daughter came out of the bedroom. And the 13-year-old boy, at that most vulnerable of all times in his growth, sociologists, society, therapists will tell you that is the crucial time in a young child's life. At 13 years old, tears are streaming down his cheeks, and he looks at me and he says, "Stop it. Stop it." He doesn't know what he's just seen. He doesn't know if he's seen his father push his mother down the steps. He doesn't know if his drunken mother has fallen down the stairs one more time. You know what I did that night? I stole. I stole from him. I stole his innocence. I stole his trust. I don't care if I'm sober 500 years. I don't care if I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for all those 500 years. I don't care if I make amends on a daily basis to him. I don't care. I will never be able in my heart of hearts to make up to that young man for what I did to him. So I'm drinking around the clock. You know, I did all kinds of things. When I came into AA, I heard insanity, and I thought, well, what that means is bizarre behavior. And so I would go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where Ann and Ed were, and I'd talk about all the crazy things I did when I was drunk. And I was sure that that's what they meant about the insanity. What happened to me is my husband began to figure out probably that there was some kind of problem. And he was a drinker, so if he drank, then he was my cover. So it never dawned on me that I should wait till he got home. By this time, I'm drinking around the clock and carrying it in my purse and swilling it out of bottles. You know, all, just a lovely sight. It was just not very pretty. And so he would come home and administer a seemingly a very passionate kiss, but it turned out to be a sniff kiss. And I remember thinking somehow he would kiss me and try to see if he could figure out if I had been drinking. And I thought, I have to somehow or another foil this. Well, it never dawned on me to wait till he came home to drink. And so what I would do, one day I was standing at the kitchen sink and I was eating peanut butter. And I remember thinking, you know, peanut butter has this real pungent aroma. It kind of wafts through the room. So what I did was that night when he came home, I saw his car pull in the driveway. I took peanut butter and stuffed it up both my nostrils. Because I didn't want to eat it. And consequently, when he kissed me, all he smelled was peanut butter. Now, the rest of the story is I darn near died, choked, because I couldn't take a breath. I would come to AA, and I would tell that story, and the old-timers would kind of roll their heads, and they would tell me to keep coming back. The insanity of the disease is that I kept drinking alcohol, getting into terrible trouble, and not realizing, making the connection between the drinking and the trouble. In 1977, I am drinking around the clock. My kids are gone to school and my husband's on a long business trip, and I am feeling sorry for myself like you wouldn't believe. Oh, it was horrible. So sorry for myself. We've moved all around the country. That I blamed my husband. I'd been 15 when I was married, 15 when I was pregnant, had these 2 kids. This husband who didn't love me, this husband who didn't understand me, on and on and on. All the things, all the litany, whatever your litany was, I had one too. I drank on it. And I love to listen to the record, and that'll date me right now, Peggy Lee, because is that all there is? Oh, I love to do that, to drink and listen to that kind of music. And what happened is I went into the bathroom and I got that moment of clarity that I pray each one sitting in this room had gotten, because I looked in the mirror and I saw myself as I really was for the first time in my whole life. And I uttered what I believe is the true prayer of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "God, help me. God, help me." I was arrogant enough to say that was the truest prayer I have ever uttered in my whole life, that was probably what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have a clue Most likely it was the prayers of my family members. No, most likely it was the prayer of clergy. Most likely it was when we sit at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and we say we'll have a moment of silence for the alcoholics who are still sick and suffering and their families. One of the things that I've learned to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is I put my money where my mouth is. If I tell you I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. And after I began to talk about that, I said, you know, I'm going to start praying for people who have loved ones that are still drinking, and I'm going to name them. And so what I've done is I have a list, and my list goes like this. It's Chris and Steve, and it's Dave, and it's Margaret, and it's Ben, and it's Corey, and it's Thelma, and it's Lark. On and on and on every day. So I see myself as I am, and I ask God to help me. And what happened is that God at that moment, I believe, swooped down and said, she's had enough. Now, what happened is not anything that I thought I liked in life. What happened is I've been going in and out of blackouts, and my daughter comes up to me one day, and she said to me, Mom, what's wrong with you? And I said, I am an alcoholic. And she gets me to a doctor, and the doctor, thank God there was a good doctor who did not believe in medication. He said, I can't help your mom, but I know somebody who can, and he got me to a counselor. And this is all happening in one day, and I go into this woman drunk. And I remember going in and looking at my shoes, and she said to me, what's the matter? And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And then I looked at my shoes because I was ready for the lecture, and you know what the lecture always consisted of. Get a job, change a job, get more exercise, read this book, on and on and on. And it always ended like this for me, and why don't you drink like a lady? And she said the three most beautiful words that I have ever heard in my whole life. She said to me, so am I. So am I. And my eyes came off of my shoes, and I began to check her out in a... And I don't mean... What I did was I looked at her from the bottom up, and you know what got me? Were her eyes. She looked at me. Her eyes were bright, and they were shiny, and they were clear. And what she did, she began to do exactly as the book said. She matched me story for story, inconsistency for inconsistency. And she talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she said, can you not drink anymore, and we'll go to a meeting tonight? And I said, well, sure, I cannot drink anymore, not knowing anything about the phenomenon of craving. And that night, when it was time to go to the meeting, I said to my daughter, no, I can do this by myself. And the next morning, I had to go an ambulance to St. Francis Hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Darkest day of my life, but it was really the brightest. It was the ninth floor of St. Francis Hospital, and it's where they mix the crazy people and the alcoholics. And what I remember is I knew who was an alcoholic, and I knew who was nuts. It was just real simple, and it's very much like a friend of mine who takes a meeting like that into a facility, takes an AA meeting into a facility like that in Texas. And he goes up to the nurse, and he says to the nurse, I'm a member of AA. We're going to have an AA meeting here. Sort out the alcoholics, sort out the crazy people. And you know what she does? She never looks at any chart. She never does anything. She moves this man. She moves this woman. It's just amazing. Well, he was fascinated by this, and he finally said, how do you know who's an alcoholic, and how do you know who's crazy? And she said, it's very simple. She said, the crazy people sit there very quietly. The alcoholics are always up at the desk telling us how to run this place. And I knew that very night that I had come home to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have a clue what was going to have to happen. I went to my first meeting of AA, and there was a man telling his story like I'm telling mine, and he had stabbed his wife. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm in with drug addicts and murderers. I mean, and I fainted at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but hope was born. What happened to me was this. I am part of a group of women and men, primarily women, that come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we don't look too bad when we come into AA, and we've not lost everything. And what happened to me, I got 12. 12-step by a neighbor. And she had been told that there was a woman who needed Alcoholics Anonymous. And there again, she came to my house. I did not call her. She came to my house. And she said, would you like to go to a meeting of AA after I'd been detoxed and signed out AMA? I said, sure. So I went to the Fox Chapel group, fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Just fell in love with it. They said home group. They said sponsor. It's exactly what I did. I got a home group and I got a sponsor. And I just tiptoed through the raindrops. Went to conferences and just bought cookies and made coffee and did all this and saw the steps on those window shades and thought, not for me. I have a slight case of alcoholism. It's like being pre-pregnant. You know, I had had a vaccine. My dad was a member of AA, so I probably don't have as serious a case as you do. And so I'm not going to work those steps. I also remember thinking, I'll stay around AA for about a year till I get the heat off. I'll learn how not to drink, and then I'm out of here. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to stay around with you people. I've got too much to do. And what happened was this. At 17 months sober, my husband called me into the kitchen, and he said to me, Marianne, it's not that I don't love you. It's that I can't live with you any longer. And here it was. Here it was. Whatever it was for you, whatever it is going to be for you, I pray that you can see it as the greatest blessing that has ever happened in your whole life. I thought, oh my God, he wants a divorce. I have been married to this man since I have been 15 years old. It's Tuesday night, and it's the Fox Chapel meeting, and that's my home group, and I come from the brand of sobriety that if it's your home group night, you better be there. And I got all dressed up, and I went to my home group, and I walked in, and they said to me, Marianne, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. And later on in the kitchen, I collapsed in their arms, and I told them the truth. And I said, I can't do this anymore by myself. Will you please help me? Will you please help me? You know, Clancy talks so much about the alcoholic being locked on the inside. And Alcoholics Anonymous can stand outside and we can beat on the door and we can kick and we can say, come on out, it's wonderful out here. Come on out, come on out. But the door must be opened from the inside. And that night, I opened up the door of my soul. And I said, I don't know what the hell's going to happen. I don't know what the hell I'm going to have to do, but I can't live like this anymore. And I'll tell you what was going through my mind at that time, other than the horrible fear of what was going to have to happen, is that I had connected with you people. I had made that connection with somebody my husband still says today on the weird shittle meter, I'm a 10. But I had made the connection with some other people who were just as weird and strange as I was. And the other thing that had happened is that I looked like the kind of person who had a connection with a power greater than themselves, and I didn't. And you all had gently and lovingly guided me to a kind and loving God. And I was terrified I was going to lose that. And I began to work the program of recovery as it's outlined in the book, which is the working of the 12 steps. Let me tell you one thing, and I talk about this a lot because it's very crucial, and you'll hear later on in my story. You can go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and you can get relief. You can call your sponsor, and you can get relief. You can read AA literature, and you can get relief. You can even work with a new person, and you can get relief. But if you want freedom, and there is a difference, you have to work the steps. So my husband and I are in the throes of this nasty divorce, and I've got this teeny tiny little job selling children's clothes and making minimum wage, and just my life on paper looked horrible. I mean, just looked horrible. And you know what AA told me? Don't look. they said, Marianne, that's a principle called living one day at a time. Do you have enough food? Do you have gas in the car? Is your rent paid? You know, well, yes, but. See, I was full of yes buts. Was told me, yes, but is the mating call of assholes. Those 2 years that Bob and I were separated, I began to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous exactly as they're outlined. I did a third step on my knees with my sponsor. I did a fourth and fifth step. I did my fifth step with a priest. I did the fifth step outlined in the book, and then I had to go to the 12 and 12 because that was the key for me, the key to unlock. And I started my fourth step. When and how did my selfish pursuit of sex injure myself or others? I did my fifth step with a Father Ben, and I remember going up there. It was a cold February morning in Pittsburgh. For those of you who know what that weather is like, and the snow was crunching underneath my feet. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I'm so afraid. And I thought, no, I'm not. I'm not afraid. I'm anxious, but I'm not afraid. And for once in my life, my timing was right. I was in the right place at the right time. And I went in and I told him everything. And what happened was this. What I had been terrified was going to happen, happened. I started to cry. And I thought, my God, I am going to cry forever. Because what I learned when I did my fourth step, I learned some things about myself. One of the greatest defects that I uncovered was that I used love as a weapon. But one of the things that I would do is I would withhold love, that I would withhold that pat on the back, the word of encouragement. And the character defect that motivated that was jealousy, always jealousy. I did 6 and 7, just blew by 6 and 7, obviously, as you heard in my story, and I went ahead with 8 and 9. Made the silly little list that you all talked about, wrote some letters because I couldn't see people. And one of the things that I did, my mother and father were both dead when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And Father Bennett said to me, Marianne, one morning when you're running along, say to your folks, wherever they are, Mom and Dad, please forgive me. And he said, then this is crucial to complete the circle, that you say, and I forgive you too. 2 years Bob and I were separated, and one day I'm going to work. I'm teeny tiny little job, and I get hit by a woman. And I hit a man on a bicycle and end up with this man on the hood of my car and thought I had killed him. And got the car stopped, and I had not killed him. And it was in the bad part of town, and the people in the town had ringed the car, and they were going to pull me out of the car and kill me. And an angel stuck her head in, and she said, is there anybody you want me to call? And I took the Pittsburgh meeting list and my lipstick, because I did not have a pen, and I wrote my husband's work number on it. I didn't know if he was in the country, out of the country, and he picked me up at the police station, and we went home like two people who had a history. And I remember sitting there talking to him, thinking, my, how he's changed. He hadn't changed at all. He had not changed one bit. But Alcoholics Anonymous had begun to do its work in me. As a result of that accident, Bob and I got back together. And, you know, what I would like to tell you is that it's been hunky-dory, wonderful ever since that. Ugh, and that, stand back, because the lightning would come if I would say that. In the book, it talks about people that have long-term relationships. It said it has to be on a different footing, because the former one didn't work. And you can take that line and you can put it in everything in your life. It has to be on a different footing. When I first walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a man by the name of Tom McConnon. He was standing right there and he looked at me and he said, Marianne, what do alcoholics fear more than anything else in the whole wide world? And I went through a litany, jail, death, on and on and on. He said, no, change. 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 Alcoholics Anonymous is about change. I would go to meetings, beginners meetings, and they said, if you don't do a four-step, you're walking around with a case of untreated alcoholism. I heard things that would send chills through my back, and it said things like this: the woman I was drank. The woman I was will drink again. The only vehicle I have to change this woman is to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the steps to do things contrary to what I want to do. When Bob and I were separated, this is my little angel story. When Bob and I were separated, I had this little teeny tiny job, and here it is. It's snowing. It's horrible in Pittsburgh, and it usually took me 20 minutes to get home. And it took me 4 hours to get home, and it was like, it was my home group night, and I thought, I don't have to do this. I don't have to go. Leroy was talking to me. I don't have to go to this meeting. I've been to a noon meeting. I don't have to do this. I don't want to do this. I can't get my car out. My car is stuck down at the bottom of the hill. I live out in the boondocks. The plow's not going to get by. But see what happens all the while I'm saying this. I'm getting ready to go to the meeting. I don't want to do this. You don't understand this. I've got too much to do. I've got to go dig my car out. I can't do this. And I'm getting ready to go to the meeting. And I get a phone call from one of my pigeons. And she said, I've got a four-wheel drive. If you can get down the hill, I'll pick you up. And I said, oh, all right. And I realized then, because Ann and I had the same sponsor at that time, she used to say to me, I cannot ask my girls to do something that I don't do. And so I got my shovel and I got my boots on, and I'm grousing and just complaining and whining to myself, walking down this hill with a shovel over my arm, saying, I don't want to go to this meeting. I don't want to go to this meeting. And all the while I'm going to the meeting. And I get down to the bottom of the hill, and the moon is on the snow. You know how it can get sometimes. It's just glorious. And I'm standing down there with this shovel over my shoulder. And a car comes over the hill. And I think it's my pigeon. And the car comes up, and the man rolls down. It's a man. He rolls down the window, and he said, do you know where the Fox Chapel Episcopal Church is? I went, whoa. I said, are you looking for the AA meeting? And he said, yes. I thought, whoa, this stuff is really powerful. And I said, you wait right here. My pigeon's going to pick us up, and we'll guide you. I mean, God gives us these little nudges every now and again that we're doing the right thing, that we're on the right track. Well, I get in the car with her, and I'm just so excited. I'm talking real fast, and we get to the meeting. And as Paul Harvey said, there is some more to the story. He sobered up in the same month and the same year that I did. He was at a business meeting, and they were drinking, and all of a sudden he realized he was in very slippery ground. And he knew he needed a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he called the Pittsburgh Intergroup, and he said to them, I am really in danger of taking a drink. Where is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous close here? And she said, I'll tell you where it is, but you'll never find it. And he drove around in the snow that night, and he's driving around, and he's coming up over the top of the hill, and he said to God, God, if I'm going to find that meeting, you're going to have to send me an angel. And there I was, standing down at the bottom of the hill. Bob and I got back together, and we moved to Texas, and what happened was this. I moved 7 years sober, and for those of you that have to move or have ever have to move, it's real scary. It's real scary. Ann and Ed saw me real sick, and I went 7 years sober, and I had learned how to talk Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had learned how to do Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet there was a lot more work to be done on me. In 1997, Bob and I were back in Atlanta, Georgia. And we were there for a graduation of our eldest granddaughter from high school. And I don't know about you, but practicing these principles in all our affairs is real easy, except when you're with family. And I was with family, and there were the other in-laws there, and there were all these kids, and there was my daughter, and there was my husband. And really what was happening was the fact that people were not snapping to when I snapped my finger. That's what was going on with me. I'll be honest with you. My ego was getting touched and pushed, and I was not in control. And one night, we were sitting there, and my husband said something, and I whirled on him. By God, I whirled on him, and I let him have it. And I saw by the look on his face, I thought, oh, I'm going to have to make amends. Now I know how to do that. See, I've learned how to do this stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I called him out of the crowd that night, and he was pissed. And I said, now, and I've learned how to talk Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've learned how to say things like, don't say you're sorry. You say, I was wrong. I know how to do all this. And so I get him aside, and I say, Bob, please forgive me. I was wrong. And, you know, when you've been married to somebody for a long, long time, you know when you're starting to weasel your way back in. And I was weaseling my way back in. And so Leroy's talking to me a little more, and he said, you keep talking. You're really getting back in his good graces. And so I'm talking Alcoholics Anonymous, and oh, I was wrong, and you didn't have anything to do with it, and on and on and on. And then a little thought came to me, and I think it was Leroy. He said, Mary Ann, you were at a meeting the other day, and somebody used this line, and what can I do to make it right? Good line. I haven't used it in a long time. And so I said to Bob, and what can I do to make it right? And he looked at me, and he said, don't do it again. Don't do it again? Oh, no. Oh, no. That's not what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. What happens in AA is you learn how to talk Alcoholics Anonymous. You learn how to do certain things. And what you do is you storm trooper over people. You say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. The heat is off for about 3 weeks. Then you go back to doing it exactly like you've done it before. Since June the 4th of 1997, I have not done it again. And that's a success story in Alcoholics Anonymous. We get to Texas, and I get embroiled in Alcoholics Anonymous down there, and I'm telling you, I had a resentment list that wouldn't quit, and it has nothing to do with people on the outside. It's all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if yours isn't long enough, you aren't going to enough meetings. And in 1989, my husband said to me, would you like to move one more time? And I said, okay, where? And he said, would you like to move to Zambia, Africa? And in 1989, I moved to Zambia, Africa, and the rubber hit the road as far as Alcoholics Anonymous is concerned. It was my time in the saddle. I went to Zambia, and I got off the airplane looking at the African bush, and I thought, my God, Mary Ann, you've done it now. And I remember thinking, is God going to strike me drunk because I cannot get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And the God that I had found in Alcoholics Anonymous, the answer to that was no. But what I had to learn at 13 years sober was this. I had to learn, and Wayne alluded to it last night, I had to learn to go inward. Enough of this surface stuff. Enough of this outside stuff. Enough of this stimulus on the outside. You're going to find out if you have any kind of a program on the inside. There was real reason for fear. Zambia is a third world country. I couldn't hardly get any food. I had to grow my own food. I had to make my own bread. I had to grind my own meat. We had bars on the inside of the windows, on the outside of the windows. We had two night guards. We had one day guard. We had coiled barbed wire on the fence. We had jail doors to the bedroom that we would shut off at night and lock with this long key. And I would lay there, and I would be so afraid. Because there was genuine, real reason for fear. You know, the book does not tell us, our literature does not tell us, that we're not going to be afraid. It tells us that we do all the program work we can with this fear, and then here is the key, the operative phrase. We deal constructively with what's left. And what I learned to do is what I have done from the very beginning. On Saturday night, you would hear the African drums, and I would get down on my knees, and I would say, God, help me. God, help me. God, help me. God, help me. You did not bring me this far, God, to let something horrible happen to me. I got to two meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in 2 years. It was 5 hours away. They wouldn't let me drive. Besides, they drove on the wrong side of the road. And got to two meetings pretty much like the meetings we have here. They have a strange accent, but it's pretty much like ours. And one day the phone rang, and this is what ties in with your theme. The phone rang, and the woman was calling me from Lusaka. I lived in a little town called Luansha. And she said, "We have a 12-step call for you to make." There were no other Americans. There were very few expatriates. And I remember thinking, uh-oh. And they said, "It's a man, and it's a Zambian." I said, "Okay." And he came to my house. His name was Costa Kanuga. And he came to my home, and he brought his brother. And he came into my living room, and he began to talk to me. He was of the Bimba tribe. And the Bimbas speak, they have their own dialect, but they do speak English, but it's very halting. And he worked in the mines, and it was not even like the mines in the United States. This is the mines where men and women die on a daily basis. And the only thing he'd ever had to drink was chibuku. And chibuku is a home brew. That's what they drink. And he was trying to tell me about drinking chibuku and getting into trouble. And I'm trying to tell him about drinking martinis in the Skirvin Hotel in Oklahoma City. And I thought, oh my God, this is not working. This is not working. This is just not going to work. And we talked some more, and I had an extra book. I had an extra big book, and I had a pamphlet, The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is my favorite pamphlet. And in there it talks about the blind seeing and the deaf hearing and the crippled people walking and the poor in spirit. And I gave it to him, and I really felt bad. I thought, I've let Alcoholics Anonymous down, that this is just not going to work. And 3 months later, there was a knock at the door, and it was Costa Kanuga, and Costa Kanuga had not had a drink in 3 months. From the heart touches the heart. And at that moment, I was able to give him a 12-step call that you all would have been proud of me. I mean, I didn't have anything to give him, so I gave him my 10-year medallion that they had given me in Corpus. I didn't have an extra 12 and 12, so I gave him the 12 and 12 that Gene had given me in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that I had taken to Corpus Christi, Texas. Somewhere in Zambia, Africa is my 12 and 12 and my 10-year medallion. My husband came home shortly thereafter, and he brought a letter, and the letter was from the Zambian government, and I looked at it. It was bad news. And I said, "Just a minute, Bob." And I went in and I got down on my knees in the bathroom, which has been since I have been sober from the very beginning. I got down on my knees and I said, "God, help me. God, help me." And I went back in, and the Zambian government wanted us out of the country. And that night, my husband and I began to formulate a plan how we were going to get our stuff and ourselves out of this foreign country. And what happened that night was a breakthrough for me also. I was 13 years sober, and I let my husband cry that night. One of the things that women alcoholics do, and some men alcoholics, is that I learned that night why I am so ready and so rapid to fix somebody in my life. If I can minimize and give you some kind of a solution to your pain and your trouble, it keeps your pain and your trouble away from me. It is still a self-centered motive. And at that night, I thought, AA better be right about this one. I remember standing there at the kitchen sink, and he's crying, and I'm keeping my mouth shut, and he finally went to bed, and this emotional pain is just like a roller coaster. It won't stop. And I remember thinking, I'm going to lose my mind. I am not going to be able to do this. And I'm washing dishes and I'm looking at the moon that's over Zambia, Africa, thinking, oh my God, they're at a meeting of AA somewhere. They're saying the Lord's Prayer. They're saying the Serenity Prayer. Please, God, help me. And what happened was the emotional pain began to level off. And then after it leveled off, it began to dissipate. And what I learned that night is I took my hands and I held them up to God and I said, I can do this. I am not a coward. I do have some integrity. I do have some fidelity. I do have some character. There is something worthwhile inside of me. Alcoholics Anonymous has finally brought this out. We finally made it home after that and came back to Corpus, and what happened was this. The amend steps that I talked to you about, they were incomplete with my family. And in 1991, I knew exactly what had to happen. We brought my 91-year-old father-in-law to Corpus Christi, Texas, and we put him in a nursing home. And then I thought, here it is. I don't know much about the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, except I do know one, and it's involved in the 10th step, and it's called perseverance. Well, what I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is to persevere. Before that, I was heroin for half a day. Boy, by God, I could do anything for half a day, but don't ask me to do it for any time longer than that. That old man was in a nursing home. That dear, sweet old man was in a nursing home. Really, the only father I ever knew was in a nursing home for 3 years, and I went to that nursing home every day for 3 years. And I took with me glad tidings of great joy. That character defect that I talked about of withholding joy, it had almost evaporated. I took pictures. I took candy. I took letters. I would sit and talk to him about his kids and his grandkids. He told the nurses at the nursing home that I was president of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like you to think that I dispelled that rumor, but I kind of liked it. What I would do to him was this. I would do what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. One day they were trying to get him from the bed to a chair, and he was having a terrible time, and I'm holding his hand while they get him to the bed for the chair. And what I did is I did to him what we do to each other. We pat each other. And what I did, I patted him and I said, "Dad, I'm here. I'm here." When he died, my husband was able to say to me, Marianne, he had two children. He had 5 great-grandchildren. But he said, "You made the difference in his life." And I was able to say to him, it wasn't me, it was Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a woman there, and she scared the living bejesus out of me. She had Alzheimer's, and what she would do is she'd pull at me, and she'd pull at my clothes, and she'd mess with my hair, and she scared me to death. I'm that little girl again. I'm terrified, and so I would go in the back door because I didn't want to see her, and I realized that Alcoholics Anonymous would not be very proud of me for going in the back door, so what I learned to do was to walk in the front door, and with each step, I would say, "God, grant me the serenity," and what happened is I would, you know, with somebody with Alzheimer's, you have to introduce yourself every day, but I did that, and I would let her pull at my hair and pull at my skirt. I mean, her name was Victoria D'Amico, and we ended up with the sweetest relationship. One day, I went in, and they'd put makeup on her. I said, "Victoria, you just look wonderful." And she looked at me with the most lucid eyes, and she said, "I wanted you to know you're not the only beauty queen around here." Now I'm going to tell you about the most important thing in my whole life, other than my sobriety and my relationship with my God. I'm going to tell you about my 2 children and my 5 grandchildren. See, I am the kind of woman that I was terrified that I was going to be a drunken grandmother and they were not going to let me near those children. And what happened is that I have 5 of them and not one of them have ever seen me take a drink. They are the most precious things in my life. In 1993, you know, talks about a family illness. Well, why did I think that one of my kids wasn't going to get it? And I began to watch my kids like a hawk, and it didn't take me very long to figure out who it was. It was my son. And for those of you that have that experience right now, I'm going to give you a promise that you can take to the bank. You can't help your kids. You help my kids, and I'll help your kids. It was my son, and what I remember is I darkened the doors of Al-Anon at that time, and I'll tell you how badly I needed Al-Anon. I stood outside the door thinking, "I don't need to go in, I don't need to go in, I don't need to go in," and so I went in, and they loved me, and they gave me wonderful guidance, and they helped me. They told me things like, "Take your son through the 12 steps," and I thought, "I'm trying to do that," and they said, "No, physically do it in your head." You know, admitted that Dan was powerless over alcohol, that Dan's life had become manageable, came to believe that a power greater than Dan could restore Dan to sanity, made a decision to turn Dan's life and Dan's will over to the care of God as Dan understood him. And I did all those things, and the tears would just stream down my cheeks, just stream down my cheeks. And in 1993, he called me and he said, "Mom, I want to quit." He was in Tulsa, and I said, "Call Alcoholics Anonymous. Call AA." And then I ran to my meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I felt euphoric and I felt horrible at the same time. And you know what went through my mind? Can Alcoholics Anonymous work one more time? Can it work one more time? he was in Tulsa, and I had gone to Al-Anon enough that I knew about the word detachment, and I threw it out the window. Because I got on the telephone, and I called the inner group in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I said, what meeting should he go to? Give me some men's names that he needs to talk to. And I flew up the next day we went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at 6:30 in the morning, and we drove up, and I'm talking to him about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we drove up, and you know what happened to me at that moment? The thing that sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, in good standing, fear. There was not a car there. I thought, oh my God, oh my God, oh my dear God, and the word that Steve used yesterday, beloved, please let somebody come. Let somebody come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous who doesn't need a meeting that day. Please let somebody come who will read how it works, who will pass the basket, who will save the things that are going to save my child's life. And by God, we came. We were late, but we came. And the thing that yesterday, listening to Steve, I'm just laughing away, having this wonderful time. And when he talked about his mother, I just lost it. Because last July 19th, I was able to give my son his six-year medallion. You know, that is a blessing that very few of us get to do. I have a 12-year-old granddaughter up there who says, Grandma, keep coming back. It works if you work it. One of the very first, that very first week, that very first time, entry into Alcoholics Anonymous, and my daughter-in-law had been going to Al-Anon, and one morning we were getting up, getting ready to go to that meeting. Do you know what time I have to get up to get ready to go to a 6:30 in the morning meeting? I mean, I was up like 4:30 or 5 o'clock, and I hear my daughter-in-law and my son in their bedroom, and they're reading the 24-hour day book. Now, it's not conference approved, but it's not conference disapproved either. You know, one of the lines in there talks about there are homes where fires are lit and prayers are said. These five grandchildren that I have a 20-year-old who is a junior at Tulane University, and she's been coming to Corpus since 1985, and she stays with me for a month every year. And she gets off the airplane, and she hands me a pillowcase, and she says, Grandma, at 5, this is when it started, I want you to sleep on this pillowcase for 1 month and not wash it. And I said, okay, Jessica, why am I supposed to sleep on this pillowcase for a month? And she said, when I go home and I miss you so badly that I can't stand it, she said, I can smell that pillowcase and I can smell you. I have a 19-year-old grandson, and I have a 16-year-old granddaughter, and I have a 14-year-old grandson, and I have this 12-year-old granddaughter. Let me tell you some more about Alcoholics Anonymous. This 14-year-old boy races cars. And he races multis. It's like the world of outlaws is what he races. And he's been racing cars since he's been 9 years old. And I go up and just have a wonderful time and watch him race. And he goes like 45 miles an hour around this track when he was 9 years old. Well, about 2 years ago, I'm up there. And he's getting to be a pretty good driver. It's open wheel. And I mean, he really goes pretty fast around this track. And he said to me, Grandma, every time I go by, you've got your eyes covered. And I said, Spencer, don't look at me. Look at the track. So he's going around this track, and one summer I'm up there, and I have the tendency to have these lofty prayers. I also have tendency to not to talk to God about what I really want so that maybe I can backdoor him, you know. And so Spencer's going around this track, and I'm saying, oh God, please, and on and on. And all. Finally, all of a sudden, he's winning. And it's like, oh my God, can you let this kid win? Well, he won. And what they do is the winner gets you to go down in the infield, and you get to have one person go down there and behind the car, and they take the picture. And he came up and he said, Grandma, I want you to come down there in the infield with me and take the picture. Last summer, I was up there, and now he's gone to a beer class. He's in the sportsman class, and he's racing against men. He's got broad shoulders, and he's racing against these men, and I thought, it's going to be a replay. It's going to be another one. I'm going to pray the right prayers. You know how to do good things, get good things. I'm going to pray this prayer. This kid's going to win. I'm going to have another picture to hang on the wall. And he's going around the track and he's winning. And it's just like, see, I have this inside track to God. All I have to do is pray and I get exactly what I want. So he's winning and he's going around the track, and all of a sudden a man hits him from the back. And he does something like you see on television. This car goes end over end over end. I thought, oh my God, that's my grandson. That's somebody that I love. My son jumped out of the infield and went to get him, and my daughter-in-law jumped up, and all I could do was cry and pray. And the next thing I know, there's this young man kissing me on the cheek. You know what I learned from that? There's an AA message there. We're there when they win, and we're there when they lose. These five kids, you know, there's a thing in the book where it talks about we quit playing the director. I think one of our speakers alluded to that. Well, I ripped that page out. Just threw it out. And what I did was this. Last summer, I worked it out. I directed it. I orchestrated it. I end up with all five grandchildren together at once in one motel room in Ocean City, Maryland. I mean, I had, you know, it talks about full flight from reality. That was me. What I thought was going to happen is I'm going to get dressed up. I'm going to get them, these kids, dressed up, and I'm going to put them around my ankles, and they're going to talk to me about how much they love me, and I'm going to tell them how blessed they are in my life, and it was just going to be magnificent. After they quit farting and fighting, oh, it was horrible. Except it wasn't. I slept with a 20-year-old little girl. And the boys are different. The boys, we bonded watching country music videos. They let me sit cross-legged behind them, and they'll let me scratch their backs. The 12-year-old loves to comb my hair and put makeup on me. And she combs my hair up in that fountain like, you know, and they all laugh at me. And the 16-year-old little girl with the long blonde hair lays her head in my lap, and I stroke her hair. At that moment, I wanted time to stop. I didn't want the clock to tick 1 second forward, 2 seconds forward. And what happened is I almost missed it. You know, I thought, I'm going to get sober and going to do grandiose, wonderful things and save 9 million people and get my picture on the paper and my face on television. I almost missed the rewards and the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of you that are old-timers, I'm going to ask one request, and I ask it from the bottom of my heart, because, you know, when Ann and Ed and I came in 1977, the rooms were full. If everybody had stayed, there would be no room for you all. So I'm asking the old timers to please keep coming back. I need somebody that has hacked away a path for me. I need coattails of courage to hang on to. I need somebody who deals with relentless reality, which is life, who exhibits quiet heroism, which is what old timers do. Please keep coming back. For those of you that are in those middle years, those awful middle years, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you know what happens then? You are confronted. I was confronted with the enormity of the work that's out there. You've kind of got everything back into shape. You've got a job. You've got your family. And all of a sudden, you see, my God, there's so much work to be done on me on the inside, and it's so slow. What I'm telling you is hold on. Hold on. I come from the brand of sobriety that I won't tell you it's going to be okay. It may go to hell, but you will be okay if you hold on. And for those of you that are new, I'm going to tell you what was told to me when I was 3 months sober. Hang on to your seat, because you're in for the ride of your life. Thanks for my sobriety. We'll be right back.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a catalog of other AA and Al-Anon tapes and CDs, or to join our Tape of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.